Welcome to Design Your Life, the podcast where we explore the central role design plays in our everyday lives and how, if harnessed correctly, has the power to positively transform the way that we live, design better businesses and sustainable solutions for the planet. We speak to creative entrepreneurs around the world about how they inspire their ideas to life and how they make it all work and the role design plays in their lives. I'm your host, founder of Frost Collective and author of Design Your Life, Vince Frost. Welcome to today's episode of Design Your Life. Today I catch up with the brilliant Danish architect Viggo Harmst, partner and director at the globally renowned architecture practice Henning Larsen. Tune in as we chat about what he learned in his first architectural job out of university working with the legendary Zaha Hadid and how to create a longer life cycle for a building and why the Danes are so good at design. Viggo, welcome to Design Your Life. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. And it's so nice to have you here in our Sydney studio, in our podcast room. We met, I guess, end of last year in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. It was really bloody freezing and wet.
Yeah, it was.
But it looked like a nice place, despite that. And it was really cool. I was over there. We had a meeting with 3XN. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. But then we came to see you at Henning Larsen, and it was just...
Well, you got some proper coffee.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. A really warm welcome and decent coffee and a good look around the office. And it was just heaving with people, and it looked like an incredible place. And yeah, it's amazing. You're a partner there and design director for APAC, APAC region at Henning Larsen. And you're one of the world's most highly regarded architecture practices. When did you know, did you want to become an architect? Was it always in you?
Oh, thank you for the kind words, first and foremost. I come from an architectural family, so my father is an architect as well. So I guess that there was a lot of drawing around growing up. Mm-hmm. And I do think I made the decision quite early. And to get to that point was through a lot of playing music and then being creative in many different kind of areas. So I knew that I wanted to work as an architect pretty early. Yeah.
Wow. Was your mom an architect too?
No, so she's not an architect, but she was a principal. So there was some kind of rigidness in the family. And I'm actually Swedish, half Danish, so my father is Danish.
Okay.
And Swedes, they lack kind of order and bullet points and so on. So there were some kind of different components embedded that was working quite well for an architectural kind of trajectory.
Yeah. So I guess your mom kind of covered the project management side of things?
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah.
So what is about
definitely
the Danes?
Definitely more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, more than that. What is about the Danes? Why are you guys so incredibly focused on or talented with design? What is that? Is that in your culture, I think, isn't it?
Well, I think that being a quite small population, but having a quite bold and curious, I would say, mentality, demands that you kind of express and try to kind of conquer and getting beyond your own borders in a way. And that also goes into craft of different craftsmanships and so on, which includes design, I would say, to be creative and to be very innovative and have an attitude a bit like take responsibility from A to B. So I think it also, of course, it connects to the to the cultural kind of heritage of working with timber, working with wood when it comes to furniture and so on. Yeah, I guess it's in the water or something.
Yeah.
But I think that the being a quite small country, a small population, but then thinking big, it's part of it for sure.
Well, you must have been thinking big because you started your career off with Zaha Hadid Architects in 2000. That was a big leap from Copenhagen. Yeah. How did that come about?
Well, I think it was part of an internship, and stayed there for around a year or so. And we were actually, it was me and my by that time girlfriend, now wife. We were supposed to actually be in Holland, and we went to OMA and so on and so forth, like everybody else. Mm-hmm. But we ended up in London. My wife got a job in London. I didn't really know who is in London, you know? So I took my naivety and then found out, okay, Saha is there, and that's super interesting, and we can discuss the design and so on. But when I was in contact and came into the office, as any other office like OMA or like the big ones, it's a super interesting environment because there are some extremely talented people, and there are some very interesting discourses internally, especially at Zaha's, where it was about very advanced computational design, married to very advanced model making, married to a quite academic approach to architecture, which was married to, you know, all the mathematics and so on that goes into that, which had, I mean, believe it or not, an over kind of umbrella of different connection between people. So I thought that, I mean, that was super interesting. Of course, I didn't know that when I came into the studio. I think I was just super intrigued. You know, it's, I did. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of vibrancy in there and so on. So I was super fortunate and lucky to then get hired there, and I stayed there for almost a year. I came back home. I was 7 kilos lighter, and I stayed up to the ceiling for 3 months. I mean, it was a lot of work.
Wow!
And I made a lot of good friends and so on, which are still my friends.
They worked you hard.
So they worked very hard.
I remember we had our studio just around the corner from there in Clerkenwell.
Yeah.
It's Bowling Green Lane. It was an old school.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I remember going in there. I had a meeting in there once, and all these desks in like an old school, but there was like 10 people per desk. Everybody was squashed into
But it
the
is
place.
Also like these different studios that you roamed around in.
Okay.
There was a model workshop, and then there was the studio up on level one where Zaha was sitting, and then was the studio down on ground level where, you know, a lot of the Italian projects were or whatever. And then at that time, they hadn't kind of made that leap becoming, you know, the 300, or now they are like a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I think when I was there, it was around 60 or 65, 80 people.
Oh, wow. Early days.
So so then 5 years later, I think they just kind of exploded.
Wow. And what was it like working? Were you working closely with her?
Sometimes. I mean, we had our pinups with Zaha and Patrick, and it was very much like in school. Of course, there were the situations where she was kind of freaking out over something and yelling and so on. And then Patrick would come in and kind of mitigate with the team and kind of pulling a bit back and so on. So it was super high-pitched, very passionate, very demanding. But, I mean, it's her name on the door.
Yeah.
And I think that even though that, sometimes it is an environment which I wouldn't promote in any way. At the same time, you know, it is a lot of passion, especially from her side.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you need to kind of balance with, you know, the explosions that come from her. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's nothing kind of personal. It is basically just to work at that high pitch.
Yeah.
And then when you don't discuss it, she was extremely, I mean, it's weird, but I would tend to say sweet and timid. And then suddenly she was at a different level. And then, you know, so.
So the work was so important to her. And
the work was extremely important to her and to everyone. You know, it's contagious. You know, you want to do your best. You learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about limits. You learn a lot about collaborating.
Well, talk about that. What did you learn about limits? Because obviously you must have pushed you beyond what you thought you were capable of.
Well, everybody were extremely... I mean, first of all, everybody were pushed because, you know, we had extremely high ambitions. And in that environment, you very quickly, also not having too much experience, you meet your limit pretty quickly. Mm. But then, as I remember it, there is always somebody there to pick you up. And then you learn, and then you move on.
Mm.
So I think that if you have the right kind of mindset in that type of environment, it can be extremely fruitful, you know. And for others, it, of course, can also be extremely devastating.
So in that 1 year, probably was equivalent to 5 years or more in terms of your learning.
Yeah, I wouldn't know, but yes, you learn a lot. Yeah, and you didn't sleep that much.
And so why did you leave? Did you just exhausted?
Well, I think it was part of both me and my girlfriend. We needed to go back, basically. Part of that was also finishing the master's and so on at school. So.
Oh, okay. Is she an architect too?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Where was she working?
Claudio Silvestrin, which is like the total opposite from Zaya did. I mean, he is like an Italian master minimalist, so it was very different.
So not long hours. What?
Well, I think they did also long hours, but it wasn't the same.
So you went back to architectural school.
Yeah, I went back to architectural school. Did my master's. I did my architectural degree, from A to B in, I think, 4.5 years or something. So I felt very much when I came back, I wanted to get out of there.
Yeah.
There's something when you work internationally, you get this kind of taste of, you know, working in different countries through Zaha's, everything that we did. And then I looked, naturally I came to work at a small practice called Nord Architects first, because it was basically part of my, tutor. So after that, I was just looking for, working more internationally again, and then Henning Larsen was the natural choice, working very much internationally.
I was just thinking about the fellow students back at the architectural school when you came back. Did they notice a change in you?
Well, we were rotating quite a lot, so I think it wasn't. I don't remember that anybody paid attention to that. And I think that Zaha at the time, you know, when you came back to Denmark, you know, when you said that you had been at Zaha's did office, you know, nobody cared. That wasn't super high on the list. Because it's about form, it's about from looking from the outside, there is a lot of people have a lot of meaning when it comes to Zaha's work. So
how did you get into Henning Larsen?
Well, as I said, I think it was a search for working more internationally. And at the time when I came into the company, they were doing a lot, both in the Middle East and in Europe. There were some things out east, in the Far East as well. And it's an amazing environment. It's a bit the same that you experience actually coming to Zaha, that you come in and you get this amazing direct kind of feedback of a environment which is creative. It's welcoming. Had some really good first projects that I was working on, and you got a really kind of good sense of it goes really fast when, and I think that's also very much a Henning Larsen kind of DNA, that if you want to take responsibility, you will be let to take responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's very high to the glass ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also what interests me. And I thought that was really is an amazing, amazing opportunity.
Was Henning still alive when he was still working there?
Yeah. Well, he wasn't working. He was roaming. And
I'm looking forward to that one day to Rome.
Yeah, yeah. So here, but I mean, I was unfortunately not working with him as other of my colleagues, but he was there roaming. This wonderful man with a lot of interest, still being quite old at the time. He would come by, the desk and ask, like, what's going on here and so on. And then you're sitting there designing some mega atrium somewhere, and he would ask you like, well, is that possible? And I would say, yeah, that's possible because of X, Y, and Z and so on. He just kind of quietly laughs a bit and says, oh, well, that's amazing. And then he moves on. So I think he was really in a good way. I think he demanded quite a lot, but he was also finding this way of giving you the freedom to move and to explore.
Yeah.
And I think that has been part of our DNA kind of moving forward. And
that's incredible that we were talking earlier about Henning and like the businesses, many practices around the world and about 750 people.
Mm.
Is there a Henning Larsen style, or there must be, is there an approach, or is you know, the influence you had at Zaha, did you bring that to the practice and have you influenced that?
No, I think Henning Larsen has a super strong DNA and design mythology. I don't think, we don't have a certain style. I do think that it's connected to something which has to do with simplicity, a strong narrative. There is a strong connection to a simple concept that comes into effect in the design. But more importantly, which we started 15 years ago, we have a sustainability department, 20 engineers, PhDs and architects that are working together with the design teams, developing sustainable strategies around material and a lot of different applied research. So this idea of informing our design before we design is extremely important, which pushes us to, of course, have creative ideas very early, but being very conscious of all the constraints that are given to us, using those constraints and molding the, those constraints into a design that I would say tries to kind of make all the mistakes as fast as possible, and then basically developing a design and that connects a lot to the place, to the context, and so on, but has also embedded the smarts of the applied research that we do, or the strategies that we are finding out through working with a specific project, what is best for this location in terms of being as energy efficient as possible, for example.
So elevating the science behind your work.
Yeah, the place. We call it evidence-based design. So that's I think that is a huge point of difference, in my opinion. And we have now, I mean, you can say that we have for a long time said that we are people-centric. I think that evolved very much when we started our sustainability department, that internally it maybe became more data-centric, and that data started to inform the constraints and the directions of the design. I think now we are at a place where we would say that we would be life-centric, because it's all the all the applied research that we're doing and all the tools that we are using is embedded in our design process. So we don't need to highlight it anymore. So there is a different, there is a bit of a different relief in focus on life in general.
Yeah.
I mean, everything in terms of biophilia or nature and materials is much more kind of multifaceted than it maybe ever have been.
And do you see that through doing that, that science and that life-centric focus, are you creating far more successful outcomes?
I would say so. They are much more holistic now than they are. Of course, it's a combination in terms of how we are collaborating with our client and what is possible. But I think our approach is much more holistic now. Mm-hmm. Also, having... we have three legs in our business. It's architecture, urbanism, and landscape. And I think that has also been honed over the past 5 years, being very collaborative between the different disciplines and integrated, which also enables us to be more holistic. And I think that results in better projects.
So a richer understanding of the place, the people, the location, etc., the science around the building and all that, does that, some people might think that creates less opportunity for creativity, but does that enhance your opportunity to be creative?
I would say absolutely. Because if we are talking about how we are dealing with climate and context and energy efficiency and the landscape around, or all the different factors, the brief and so on, it quite quickly becomes quite technical and quite kind of engineered based. But the other half is the pure architectural creativity, which is then kind of married to the more technical part of that process. So I think that there is always a over, there is always a searching for getting the sweet spot where you have this kind of functional poetry, where you have equally amounts of smarts with the poetic of space and the quality of space and light and for example the materiality that is working together with the light and so on and so forth. So I think there is a search every time that we are doing our design that there needs to be that combination, which is basically enhancing the business case for the client, or being in the extreme as it state of the art functionality for whatever typology there is, but not to forget the design, that it actually has that connection to those constraints and it looks beautiful, but it at the same time has the high ambition of design excellence.
Are you still sketching or is it?
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. So that's interesting in a time when you've got all that data, you've got all that technology, the science, et cetera, and AI is obviously must be used in some way through that. Will it be long before, you know, AI can design the total product? You don't have to answer that.
No, but I think we are not scared of AI. I think we are trying to kind of get closer to what the possibilities are. We are exploring that. I think that it will take a lot of time for that to happen. I don't think that, of course, we are not interested in that, but we are super interested in how we can use AI in order to accelerate some different processes, but also get us a different tool set of information.
Yeah.
And I mean, the sketching part of it is that the parameters that are given of some certain constraints for a design process, that has been then it's basically frozen, and then you have a sketch process, which is basically then trying to kind of solve the problems or the constraints that has been given to you. So it's an iterative process for sure.
And is it every when you tackle every project, do you like? I mean, I don't know, we work on a brand or a book or whatever. Every time you try to create something new. Do you have that same kind of mindset that every building we're going to do is different, has different kind of usage, different kind of location and all that? Do you deliberately try to create something new every time?
I think it comes quite natural because the environment is often different. But there are some certain aspects of different typologies that you are looking quite cleverly at. How can we repeat? You know, for example, if you're doing a tower, there is a repetition. There might be something with the facade system that we've learned and so on and so forth. So, of course, there is a portion of what can you reuse or maybe refine, you know, because there might be some interesting, you know, like we were doing this concept here that was about layers. The other one was about a cubic kind of constellation. Maybe we should try to explore this with the layers in this project because it's a low building. It has a different type of flexibility because it's within a close to a forest with a lot of trees, and maybe, you know, so there are some aspects of looking into your back catalog and see like what did we learn and how can we refine that. But I think, you know, we're not copying what we are doing, and I think it comes natural that wouldn't be interesting for us.
We talked earlier about the fact that in your practice and a lot of architecture practices, they tend to spend 1,000 hours on a pitch. I mean, we think that we spend a lot of time on a pitch, and it's probably a couple of hours, a couple of days, or a week, or something. So, 1,000 hours is such a long time. Our projects are so much more agile and a quick turnaround. It's interesting that what's it like to do an architectural pitch? Because you must you do them frequently, no doubt. That's how I guess most architects get their work.
I think that changed a lot over the past 5, maybe 7 years, that pitches has become, you know, you've gone from the classical international competition where you have a brief and then you do a competition for 8 weeks, let's say, to pitches that are invited different teams, or the client has invited different teams with a much smaller or more brief, not too many informations in the brief. So it's more open-ended.
Vague,
but for a reason, I think for most of the time, then maybe they also kind of underline it that we don't want to see any design. So they want to see an approach, but they are clearly saying that we don't want to see any sketches.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? So pitches are based on the client understanding your approach and your ability to work together in a collaborative environment. I think that's extremely interesting. I find it super interesting because depending on what the assignment is, there is an opportunity to understand your client far better and getting to know them through that process. They might give you an option of well, you can come in every week or you can come in at the end and present whatever you want. And I think in all cases, I would like to meet them as much as possible and have that kind of collaborative kind of environment evolve. And I think that some of these pitches, they are then orchestrated around us presenting back to the client what we think that their brand is or what their project brand is, maybe, you know, without showing any design. And I think for us that has been working really well in terms of I think that the client feels that there is a curiosity and there is an ambition from our side to do a bit of digging and being interested in what the client is about.
Interested in them, which is important.
Interested in them, and through that knowledge, you can answer differently in terms of what they are asking you to actually do,
and eliminate the guesswork, I guess, which is often there an element of that.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you talked about Henning. When did he start the business? He must have been...
1949, I believe it was.
Okay, wow. And I mentioned this earlier, just thinking that he grew this business quite substantially. He was an architect, still very involved, very hands-on. But what is it that made that business grow to be the size it is today and the success it is today?
I think it is very much around in the beginning about the curiosity and the fearlessness of working abroad. There was a curiosity from the business or from Henning's side that to explore new markets. I think we talked about it before. To live is to travel, or to travel is to live, with H.C. Andersen, the famous author, said, and I think that. That somehow also fits very well to the business. And I think that combined with the way that we collaborate, I think that has been a quite huge foundation of the success of Henning Larsen. And of course, it's a business that is run really, really well. The way that we have been looking at international projects is often that There is a attention to risk that has made us making some leaps internationally, and being very conscious and fortunate to win some significant projects that has been taking or let us take some steps in order to get recognition and grow as a company.
Well, I remember when we were working on you know, when we heard that Henning Larsen had won the competition in Darling Harbour, we're like, wow, another Danish firm is here. But maybe it was
another Scandi.
Yeah. Was it that had Henning been doing any projects here prior? I don't think so.
Well, we were fortunate enough to win a university building up in QUT, at QUT in Brisbane.
Yep.
And that was basically constructed and finished by the time that we did the competition for Darling Harbour. So that was the, and we've done some competitions prior to that, but there hasn't been a focus on Australia as such.
Like, is there much work going on in Copenhagen? is it all outside? Is it you guys working around the world?
I mean, we have, basically there's a lot of work in the Nordics for us, but we also have a lot of work going on from our offices in Munich, New York, and Singapore and Hong Kong. So I think that there is, I think that's also the diversity which has kind of been part of the success when, you know, economies go high and low and so on.
Yeah.
The diversity of work that we have across the globe is then, of course, a good place to be in order to kind of handle those situations.
I guess you share when one's down.
Yeah, one's as well. Up. But it also, markets, they move differently in terms of economy and so on.
Do you enjoy traveling?
I enjoy traveling, for sure, absolutely. You learn from it.
Yeah, hands.
You also learn what you miss.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, we're working on the Darling Harbour project with you guys, and we did the branding, the marketing for Darling Park.
Mm-hmm.
Complex project, reimagining two existing commercial towers and a new 183-meter tower, including more than 10,000 square meters of park space. It's an incredible project. Do you want to talk a bit about it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that the special thing about that project is that we never focused on the tower. And that was a competition, 8 weeks, I think, with a interim presentation here in Sydney. So that was a week out of that process. So, and then you have 1 or 2 weeks as a mobilization. So effectively, there was a design process of 6 weeks, perhaps, maybe, not even. So we focused a lot on that project to try to kind of make that district with the buildings behind and the whole CBD to connect down to the water, and that was very clear in the brief. But we treated the approach to finding the right solution as an urban planning exercise almost. So it was very important for us to design something and also the catchment of people and the foot traffic, so it enabled people that maybe didn't want to go to the podium, which we have designed as a village, that they needed to go to that commercial component, that we created spaces and footpaths for them to actually access the city. And by doing that, they would walk through or past our project.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was extremely complex, and we used a lot of time doing that. So, and then in the end, we also then designed the tower. And I think the uniqueness about that and that project is also the mega ambitious brief that was given by the client. 6,500 square meters of public park, I think it's the biggest one going to be constructed in Sydney over 100 years or something.
Wow.
So it is a truly kind of city changing project. And the podium as such has an open air retail street going right through the whole podium.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense of walking about in the podium is very more an outdoor sense, walking up and down stairs, going to explore, much more like a village in maybe Italy or something, but with a lot of authenticity and atmosphere, which we have tried to marry with, you know, the Bay Areas of Sydney. So you can predominantly just say that, you know, that project is about a park by the harbor with a village in that park. And in that village, there's a very high building.
Yeah.
And
we have the climate for it too. It's funny how in the past, the buildings weren't as open as they are now.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole podium is catering for that. And I think that we worked a lot with the wind simulations that we are doing in-house too, which was good because of the jagged design of the village. It helped us to actually refine when we understood the prevailing wind, where do we have pressurization, where do we have wind tunnels and so on, to slightly kind of refine the village to actually accommodate and make a much more kind of calmer public domain and comfort situation. We have 26 green walls that are leading up to the park, so there is a lot of there's a lot of nature which is brought back into the city and so on. And it not to forget that it is also a huge workplace.
It's the light down there is incredible as well. The reflection from the water, etc. How did you deal with that?
Well, I mean, the facade of the tower is quite kind of special. We have a 1750 module of the facade, which we break in four ways. So it gets this kind of slightly triangulated expression. So it's quite rich facade. And that was also to kind of take out all the sort of horizontals of the slabs in the tower. So it's a much more vertical expression of the facade. And the triangles, they actually end up with making a totality of the facade being 16% more energy efficient, because the angle glass is like moving away from the direct sun radiation, and it's creating shade on the next module and so on. So that combined creates that energy efficiency output. But what was interesting also for us is that we are close to a body of water. And on that body of water, you have this kind of glimmering on the surface, which happens when, you know, you move around the tower. When the sun hits the tower, you get that glimmering vertically on the facade. And, I mean, we've been working with First Nations people in other parts of the world. And we weren't really kind of sure how that would be implemented. But as a first thing for us, that was the connection to country, with the water being kind of, or the facade being inspired by water and by light. So I think that facade is truly what we also talked about before, is a consequence, and it's really a functional poetry of a facade.
Wow. That sounds beautiful too. I can't wait to see it built. When does it start, or has it already been started?
We are just going into detailed design. So hopefully we will get into ground in the next couple of years.
Yeah, amazing. The buildings are going to be more sustainable from the outset, more relevant, more connected with the land and environment and people. Does that mean that your buildings then will last longer? Because there's kind of some buildings that are up for, I'm not saying yours are, some buildings are up for 15 years, 20 years, and already been talked about, they're no longer sustainable, or they need to be pulled down and replaced. What's the average length of a life expectancy of a building?
Well, in Sydney, the towers and the average life expectancy of a tower in Sydney, that's around 27 years.
Yeah, so
that's
nothing. Short, isn't it?
It's very short. And to answer your question, if with all these things embedded, if we have a longer life cycle for the buildings, I would say yes, that's our ambition. I do believe when we are, it's not always that the conditions around is actually giving you the opportunity to be as efficient, energy efficient as possible, but that is of course all the time what we are striving for. And I think that if you don't put any green bling bling on, or if you don't have anything to do with the facade or anything, or the systems in the building, the facade is of course part of it. We can be thinking cleverly about the climate, the conditions, 30 to 35% more energy efficient than if we wouldn't think about and orchestrate the building around those parameters. So that is a knowledge which we have. And I think that is throughout the lifetime of the building. And that is for free. Then on top of that, you can then have a discussion with your client or whoever that you could put PVs on. You could connect it to different kind of systems in the building that would make it even more energy efficient. So I think we're trying to achieve the best framework ever to move towards a net zero strategy, which is very difficult.
It's interesting. This might sound a really stupid thing to say, but the Empire State Building, from my understanding, is the first skyscraper in the world of that height. Well, why is it still standing today? Like,
I mean, it is New York, no?
It's made of brick or stone or like?
I wouldn't know that. It's a combination of brick, not brick, but stone and steel.
Yeah.
For sure.
But isn't that incredible?
It's incredible
that it's still there, still solid, still highly regarded. I don't know how sustainable it is. So I guess it's sustainable the fact it's still standing.
That's a good point. Yeah, for sure. I mean, to work with it in that way and to have, you know, the building standing there longer is, of course, a very good outcome, 100%. But you also need to be conscious about that the design can actually outlive that and be that, finding that sweet spot when it's both classical, energy efficient, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the Harry Seidler MLC building here in Sydney. I mean, it's an amazing tower. It stands extremely... extremely elegant.
That's true.
It's just been renewed down at the base.
Yeah, we actually worked on the signage for that renewal, which was a really exciting project.
Yeah, but I think it's a very good question, and it's one which we are dealing with every day. And life cycle assessment on the buildings is something also that we are looking at. And I mean, it has become quite complex to be an architect in terms of all the information that you need to kind of cater for. You want to do and want to kind of open the books as much as possible to also have a collaboration with your client where there is a dialogue that is for sure going to mature over time as you get to know each other. You know, like I come in and I push for the public domain, I push for having stairs at the right places and to get the qualities for people, whereas of course there are commercial drivers which is pushing in a different direction, and it takes a bit of time to find a balance in that. But I do find that the working climate here in Australia, for example, not diminishing any other kind of markets, but there is a very, very sound, very professional environment to find that balance. Mm-hmm. There is not a rejection in a way that is disrespectful. The waves can go high in the meeting rooms and so on, but you go out after that and you have a beer and then you talk about how is your family and so on. Yeah. So it's a very down-to-earth on a tier one project like, for example, Darling Park or Lighthouse. That's the environment that we are working in, which I feel is quite special.
It's really interesting because I think it's architects in the past have been kind of accused of not being designing for people, which has always sounded ludicrous to me.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, a lot of architects, it's not like that anymore. I mean, I guess 10, 20 years ago, you'd very rarely see people in kind of architectural kind of renderers and things like that. Now it's just it's so porous and so transparent and so biophilic, and it's just they're completely changed. It's unrecognizable almost the way that architecture is embraced, or it's almost been like a new lease of life, really, literally life. And so have you seen that change in your short career? You're not that old, so like maybe you haven't.
Well, I do think that there is a mega shift in everything that we've just been talking about, life size, cycle assessment, about the building and the sustainability part and so on. And that in effect, of course, has a huge focus on people. And as I said in the beginning, it's a huge focus on life in general.
Mm-hmm.
And that that comes in parallel with the world that we are living in, which is, it's a state of urgency.
You know?
And I think that's also, you know, what we are such a big part of that responsibility as an architect.
Huge.
We are practicing people strategy, you know, in the broader sense to make that better. But at the same time, there is a consequence of the buildings that we are designing, and that is a huge responsibility in terms of how that ties into the environment for people.
Yeah.
And that's not maybe all the time when that holistic view is landing on the table.
What's your favorite city in the world apart from Sydney?
I love LA actually. I really like LA. I really love Rome. It's two kind of contrast perhaps, but I was surprised by LA when I was there the first time. The big contrast and so on, but it does something.
And how often do you walk into buildings, you know, I guess large skyscrapers, and feel like not only your own, of course, but other people? What other buildings have you walked into, you go, oh my God, this feels amazing? You might not want to talk about your competition, but you know, be generous.
No, for sure. I think that I think it's a very kind of peculiar design in many ways, but I do think that UN Studios Mercedes-Benz Experience Center is that was quite amazing. I think it was unpredictable,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that the flow through that building, the craftsmanship.
Is that in Munich?
That is in Stuttgart.
Oh, Stuttgart.
Yeah, I thought that made something that was really interesting, I think.
So sadly, Henning Larsson passed away in 2013.
Mm.
So how has it been for you as a partner and the leadership team in kind of carrying on his legacy and taking the business to the future?
I think quite early on, the partner group, they worked towards working from, you know, Henning as a leader towards a partner group as a leadership team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has grown into what we today like to say is our design community. So I think that there is a very direct attention to that. The community, the sense of community, is really important for us mm-hmm. as a company.
Yeah.
So I think that the partner group was constructed in a way to actually carry that further. And I think that derives from how Henning was as mm-hmm. a person.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the going from Henning to the partner group and then orchestrating and building the company with the sense of the design community has been very conscious. And that is also what we're trying, what we are working very hard with today and very consciously, that when we have offices in Sydney and New York and so on and so forth, there is always a mindfulness around and creating that sense of community, that you are part of a larger whole, and that we also are very dialogue based. We have a very kind of attention to that the best idea wins, which in that dialogue can be the intern or it can be whoever.
Yeah.
And I think that is carried on also from Henning, and it's basically the foundation of the company as it is today.
It's a really cool legacy that he's left, isn't it? That allowing or growing, but kind of the business kind of has got a new lease of life,
mm-hmm.
created an environment for people to thrive in
mm-hmm.
during his lifetime, but also past, and that can go on for hundreds of years
mm-hmm.
going forward. It's quite such a cool.
I think it has a lot to do with the ability to give responsibility.
Mm.
And to believe in people.
Yeah.
It sounds maybe like a cliche, but I think in where it also is a huge need of leadership, the equal need of giving responsibility is fostering that leadership.
Yeah.
And that is also a very big part of the community that we are growing and that we are working with constantly. Yeah. So pay it forward. Be very conscious about you know, clarity around roles and leadership and so on, as you can be, but at the same time be very attentive when there is a will to take responsibility, where there is an opportunity to serve a responsibility, because we are building the platform for so many different careers.
Yeah.
And I think that's also you know, that's of course the foundation in many ways of the company. It's people.
That's fantastic what you just said. I really resonates with me what you just said. What other projects are you working on?
Well, so here in Australia, we, of course, have the Lighthouse in Sydney. We are working on the Canberra Theatre that we won 1 year ago, or more than 1 year ago, 1.5 years ago. It's an amazing cultural project and also transformation project where there's a new 2,000-seat venue theatre. We are also working on 101 Albert Street in Brisbane, which is also a 200-meter tower right in the center of the CBD.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting project that also is right opposite the new metro station that will come in Brisbane. So it's been extremely important for us to, you could say, we're almost kind of lifting the tower and do like a public domain, a public plaza underneath the tower. So I think that's the project that we are currently working on in Australia. And I think we have around 25-30 projects ongoing globally at the moment.
Wow. How do you get, do you guys share that with each other? Do you get to see what the whole practice is doing across the organization?
Yeah, so we have a design community with the design directors meeting.
Mm-hmm.
From each market. So we have that bi-weekly where we share what is going on and so on. And it's not only the design directors. So the project managers, they have their forum. We have the lead designers, they have their forum. So we have different streams that is basically, working and cross-pollinating knowledge across the different markets and different offices. That's part of working with the design community as such.
Yeah, fantastic. That transparency is cool.
Transparency is very important, absolutely, yeah. Mm. So that is then shared, out in the organization and different forums when you get like an understanding of this is what they're doing in Hong Kong and so on. And then, of course, we have our intranet, which everything is posted and so on internally that when something happens.
Yeah. You're a busy guy. You're flying all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing these thousand hour pitches.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. What do you do for your own general well-being?
Yeah, very good question. Well, I try to run 3-4 times a week. I run early in the morning when I'm home. I try to run before the family wakes up and so on. I try to get the sleep I need, so it's very basic. Mm-hmm. I don't eat any meat. I don't know if that's doing any good for
me.
But
how long have you been vegan or vegetarian?
It's pescatarian, so it's been over 4 years now.
You feel good?
Yeah. I feel better than as I remembered when you were eating meat. There is a lightness to everyday kind of embodiment of when you are kind of roaming and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Do you drink alcohol?
Yes, I do. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
A lot?
I would say that I would drink as anyone else. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, okay.
I did.
I'll drink you under the table.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you will.
No, I don't drink. But I did notice that when I was in Copenhagen, there was a lot of people drinking a lot of alcohol.
Oh, yeah.
But it's the same everywhere. I mean, it's just crazy. But there is a trend. There's a trend that I see a lot of people that I know, a lot of friends who have tried taking a month off, and then it's been 6 months and a year, and, they feel so much better.
No, but I did that for over 6 months, and I must say that I really enjoyed it. But, in the Nordics and in Denmark, we have 6 months of the year is pretty dark, and it's cold and so on. But when spring hits, you get out, everybody gets out and you have after work beer or whatever. And I think that there is a cultural shift when that happened, you go down and then you say, well, do you have something without alcohol? And the other person goes, oh, are you not drinking? No, I'm not drinking. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't really the purpose of not drinking, to create that kind of weird situation. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm kind of over talking it, but I think that was not part of the package of just leaving alcohol. So
it goes away after a while, that kind of people trying to convince you to do it.
No, it's the other way around. I think you embody something which is creating a bit of a weird situation, and then you can be fine with that.
Yeah.
But that wasn't really the purpose why I stopped drinking.
Oh, okay.
It was just to test, what's going to happen and how good do I feel, and I do it. And then when I started drinking wine again, I now drink totally different than I did before.
Is it what, more controlled or something?
Well, I just got more
interested. Only three bottles a night.
No, it's just more interested in wine and being conscious of what you're drinking in a different way.
Tell me, what's it like when you said 6 months of the year is dark?
It's not total darkness, okay. but it is very dark. I must say that it grows on you. And for example, a couple of weeks ago, there was a light shift when it started to become a bit more light when you leave for work autumn. And so on.
Yeah.
And that's our spring, by the way.
Oh, spring, yes.
Yeah.
Spring.
So that and that is a huge change. And
makes you feel good, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. It's like revelation every time.
Have you designed your life?
I hope not.
Oh, why?
No, but I think that if I would have done that, I don't know. Like, it would have been a bit boring, I think. I think I tried to stay really open. I tried to stay really curious. I think that there is a tendency, if I would have designed my life, if I'm understanding you correctly, I think it would... It creates a lot of limitations.
Mm.
I do think that there is something about that, what you say, which I think is interesting, is maybe more about being very conscious of how disciplined you can be without that becoming a baggage.
Yeah.
And so discipline and being very disciplined about time and so on, and discipline what you are doing is of course creating more, in my view, more free time, more attentiveness of things around you. I think it's extremely important to be conscious about that, you feel that you have a surplus.
Energy.
Energy and but more like very conscious about, energy is one thing, but the sense of surplus gives you the ability to kind of give more around you. I think that's extremely important in a creative environment, because otherwise I wouldn't be as good as I could be to kind of help others or discuss with others.
I love that. That's going to be the title of this podcast. Designing a sense of designing a sense of surplus. I love that. But you're saying that because you've been through times that you were just completely burnt out, or what?
Well, yeah. It dawned on me a couple of years ago that how can I orchestrate my everyday in a better way so I don't feel that I always hunting, I'm always have too many emails, I always have, you know, back-to-back meetings and so on and so forth. I have a challenge with being attentive when we have design pinups and so on and so forth. And it just dawned on me that if I don't feel that I have that surplus, then that's the problem. Yeah. So then I need to find ways to, how do I get surplus? Well, you know, that is to be more disciplined in terms of how you use your time, of course, and so on. But, you know, you can sense that in many different ways. For me, it was just very kind of, you know, stupid, smart, or whatever, that the surplus factor is an easy one to have as a barometer in your body and in your mind. And for me, that worked really well. So you can go up in the morning and you can feel that if I don't have surplus, when I go out, I need to do something to get that back.
Then what would you do?
Well, I think it's, for me, it has a lot to do with being quite disciplined on some things about the running, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Being very conscious that I don't need to do everything, that I leave space for different types of discussions, and not trying to kind of close everything exactly when they come in, you know, and that's also kind of diversifying a bit when you attack different things, and being very clear about roles, being very clear and about like how we can help each other in order to kind of get the result that we need, being open about that, because otherwise you tend to, okay, I'll take that, I'll take that, I'll take that, and that's a fantastic, that's how it should be. But sometimes then you're trying to do everything yourself, and that's not good.
And you feel like you're drowning.
Well, I mean, you have super talented people around you. You know, like sharing what we are doing and sharing how we can actually get to the highest possible kind of quality and the best outcome, I think has a lot to do with sharing. You know, and being approachable and being open about that.
So where did you learn that? Because it sounds like you've, like you're a very wise chap, or you had a great coach. Like that's really cool what you're saying. You must have hit a really low point in your life, which we haven't talked about, but it's a bit late now because we finished the podcast.
Yeah, for sure, exactly. No, but I do think it comes out of being very conscious that you are close to hitting a wall, and you start to reevaluate a lot of things. And I do have trusted persons that I actually have those conversations, not one or two, I maybe have two, three, four.
Yeah.
And then you have like your check-ins and you try to kind of bounce the ideas and you get knowledge and you get wisdom from these people. Yeah. I think that one of the best things that I think I learned from that was to have was to ask questions, you know. And to get how do you deal with that and that and that and that? And then you can form your own consciousness around how do I then deal with that. But you're right. I think, the past 5 years or so, I think in that period of time, I think there has been a lot of thinking around how to navigate in a very kind of stressful environment.
Yeah. I mean, a high-powered role, working internationally, kids, et cetera. Like, I had the same thing. But also with COVID, it was a rethink of our values in life and all that as well.
Mm.
A lot of people 100%. Kind of revalued, nature, home, family, et cetera.
Absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You're totally right. That's part of it.
I find that even today, I mean, I've done a lot of work on myself, and you're never done. And, and a lot of these conversations is about still learning.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sometimes you can just say yes to too many things,
thinking
they're not all going to happen at the same time, and all of a sudden they all hit you, and then you feel like you're drowning.
No, but that's a classic, right? And I think that's a bit what I meant by being disciplined and being very conscious about not saying yes to anything, everything. But if you say yes to a lot of things, then you need to be very conscious that I can't do all of that, so I need to have a conversation with somebody that can help me with that. You know, so but the good thing about that is that you get shit done, but you need to take responsibility of it. But it doesn't mean that you need to do it yourself.
Yeah. It's interesting because we're both working in, I mean, different fields, of course, but we're still working in commercial creative.
Mm.
You know, we're not artists. Creative people that get paid to do, a lot of investment goes into the projects that we do. So a lot of responsibility.
Mm.
On those projects and often tight timing. You can always feel like you need more time to do your job and do it better. But it's interesting that I wonder that being a commercial creative, I don't know if you think that way, but I think that way about what we do is we want to help individuals and organizations to be the best they can be, often through their brand work and things like that.
Mm.
And it's... you might have done a brand for a restaurant before or designed a book or a wayfinding system before, but each project has its own nuances and time factors and also different people working on it, that sometimes you work with a group of people, it's really amazing and the energy is fantastic and it feels effortless. Other times it feels like you keep hitting a wall along the way. Do you ever experience that? Your projects feel like they're all the same through with your sense of surplus energy that you've got?
I had to think there for a minute, but
I saw you thinking.
Yeah, I don't think it's I don't feel that. I feel that it's very different each time. Mm. I think we're circling around the same topics, but I do think it's extremely unique each project, everything from the people and how we approach it and so on. So I think it's a very varied environment.
Mm.
Yeah.
Viggo, it's been so cool to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening in to today's episode of Design Your Life with Henning Larsen partner and director Viggo Haramsk. Tune in the next episode where I catch up with Aidan Anderson, the phenomenal founder behind the Australian publishing production company, The Local Project. Thanks for listening to this episode of Design Your Life. If you'd like to find out more about how you can design your life, head to the website at designyourlife.com.au. If you found this episode inspiring, please don't forget to review and subscribe. If you have any ideas or like to get in touch, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email at hello@frostcollective.com.au.